I was feeling called to practice with metta and mudita just because of the spirit of the times that we're living through. And I'm really, really interested as the heart moves towards awakening and goes through this process of simplification, letting go of the process of constructing experience. And allowing the construction to get more and more simple. At one point, perhaps we're like right next door to Nibbana. The simplification has gotten so subtle and so refined that perhaps a moment of grace will help the heart tip over into this experience of that's free of greed, aversion, and delusion. That isn't constructing. I'm really interested that as we move towards Nibbana and awakening, how do we live these teachings in response to the times that we're living in? It's times of divisiveness and chaos and belligerence and war and tribalism and distrust. And when we tune into the new cycle, our hearts and our bodies can be inundated with the troubles, right? Which can lead to some, feels to me, can lead. It's not always the case, but it can lead to some faulty conclusions about ourselves, about other human beings, about life itself. That life itself is all suffering, right? That humanity is a complete mess and irredeemable. There's someone really close to me who trusted me with, it was very moving, just trusted me with his upset and despair around the times that we're living in. And it's so easy to fall into hopelessness and despair.
Not really.
Not really.
Oh, I thought I was muted.
No, that's
I
okay.
guess,
Yeah.
it is and it isn't, right? It's a habit we create, I think. Anyway, I didn't mean to do that. I really thought I was muted.
It's okay. It's
Sorry
okay.
to interrupt your talk.
It's okay. It's okay. And that's what I love about these talks and these teachings. They land in your heart and you get to be in conversation with them. And it may be that some of the things I say don't quite resonate, they don't land. And it's good to know that. It's good to track that experience. And as Isabel was saying, both are true, right? The heart can fall into these habits of wanting things to be other than they are. And there can be a view that these habits can have us turn to a view that is out of balance at times. And this is why I love practicing metta and mudita during these times is it helps to balance the view. It helps the heart to start to tune in and be aware of and drink in the friendliness that's around us, the care, the benevolence of, say, metta, or the joy of mudita, right? And it's not just any joy, as we were discussing in April when I was last here, and as some of you have practiced, you know that mudita is not just any joy, right? Our Dharma ancestor, Buddhaghosa, reminds us that it's sympathetic joy, it's resonant joy, it's altruistic joy, right? It's when the heart of friendliness and care comes in contact with the happiness of another person or another being. Our heart fills with their happiness. When we witness the beauty, the goodness of another being, but it doesn't have to be another being, it can be some situation, a place. The heart kind of stands up and resonates in a joyous recognition. My sweetheart and I were out at Lake Lagunitas this morning, and there was this family. I'm assuming I don't know all the relationships. It seemed like there were grandparents and parents and two little ones, both toddling about. And the boy, actually, the whole family felt pretty harmonious. And the boy was just running and racing and pointing things out and totally delighted and excited. And the adults were reflecting back to him his happiness and his curiosity and engaging. And to look on this family, and especially to take in this boy's happiness, my own heart was gladdened, was filled with his happiness and delight. And my heart celebrated that here was a young person who had parents and adults who were attuned and tending to him so that he could feel their delight in him. He knew that he mattered to them. He mattered to them. And in that process, if that continues, he'll internalize that for himself and he'll carry that with him. It's a real gift. We're practicing with mudita just to remind us that life isn't all challenge, it isn't all difficulty. That the gladness of mudita, the joy of mudita, can be experienced directly in the body, in our bones, and that it can actually be a support for the awakening process, this gradual movement towards nibbana, a heart free of greed, aversion, and delusion. So sometimes the question can arise in practicing mudita, because some people, they hear about mudita and they're like, I don't know about all this. Like, I don't know about all this. Am I being asked to celebrate all kinds of happiness that people experience? And the question can arise for us, what about those people who derive happiness from harming others? And very clearly, mudita is not about celebrating that kind of happiness, the unskillful movements of the heart like Schadenfreude, this deriving pleasure from another's failure. That's the exact opposite. That's what Buddhaghosa called the far enemy of mudita in the Visuddhimagga, this ancient text. Has all these different practices that Buddhaghosa, who was a practitioner and a scholar and a commentator, he commentated on various texts. In the Visuddhimagga, he makes it really clear that one of the far enemies of mudita, the exact opposite, is Schadenfreude. So we're not celebrating that kind of pleasure that someone derives from someone's difficulties or failures, right? We're not resonating with another who derives their happiness from an unwholesome intention, which usually comes from confusion or pain or ignorance. There's some pain, and the person doesn't quite know out of ignorance how to relieve that pain, that challenge, that difficulty in a healthy way. As my teacher, Linda Tai, will say, sometimes some of us haven't been taught to suffer with grace, to undergo challenges and difficulties with grace. Gil Fronsdale talks about it as having a reverence for our dukkha, for our suffering, for our challenges, for our difficulties. And I'm making this gesture because I've seen Gil work with various practitioners. And he'll encourage them to hold their difficulties, to hold their challenges with real tenderness. And he's actually encouraged them to kind of speak their challenges, and as if their challenges could rest in their hands and be held tenderly with this reverence, right? So people who derive their happiness from someone else's failure, right? There's confusion. There's ignorance there. There's a lack of understanding how to be with the challenges of life. and they end up reacting or lashing out or causing pain or difficulty for others. And they actually move their pain through other people. They move their pain through another person's nervous system. And when our wise, caring hearts actually see this confusion, compassion can arise, right? So we're not delighting in the deluded happiness that arises from someone who enjoys causing harm. We're celebrating the happiness that actually leads to freedom, that leads to awakening. So there's an ancient text. It's in I'm looking behind me because I thought the Nikaya was there, but it's in the Anguttara Nikayas. I think it's the Book of 11, where the Buddha reminds us that gathered and collected heart mind, the energies, the gathered and collected energies of the heart mind. When I say energies, I'm not being vague. There are specific faculties of the mind that start to gather and collect the faculty of attention, the faculty, or you wouldn't call it a faculty, but vedana and perception and contact and intention. They all start to gather and collect around the meditative experience. The mind is quite whole. This is the word samadhi, and it gets translated as concentration, but it's really a gathering and collecting, a weaving together of these different faculties around a particular meditative experience. And in this ancient text, we're reminded that a concentrated mind, a gathered mind, arises out of a happy mind state from the steady application of energy to practice. It's filled with patience, it's filled with kindness, it's filled with restfulness, aliveness, encouragement, it's embodied. The heart mind is pivoting from the unwholesome towards the wholesome. Even when we're experiencing the unwholesome or the lack of skill within the heart mind, there's still the aspiration that we're pivoting to. We're being with the unskillful, learning about it as a support for moving towards freedom and awakening. And this text, reading this text in the Book of 11s, was such a revelation for me because I've seen it in myself. I've seen it in other practitioners where we think we need to berate ourselves or be kind of rigid or whip ourselves into samadhi. But this isn't the case. This is from the Book of 11s. This is the Buddha. He says, for one who is happy, for one who is happy. He doesn't start out for one who is rigid, for one who is overly concerned and trying to achieve a particular experience, but for one who is happy, there is no need for an act of will, quote, may my mind be concentrated, end quote. It is natural for one who is happy that their mind will be concentrated. It is natural for one who is happy that their mind will be concentrated. Didn't hear anything in there about striving, nothing about berating ourselves, not forcing the mind into samadhi. Happiness. A happiness born of a contented heart, mind, body. A happiness born of tranquility and kindness and patience. Just being content with the simple experience of just offering one mudita phrase at a time. One of the ways, there are a few ways to cultivate mudita, but one of the ways that's come down in the Theravada tradition is just offering these phrases to what's called the happy being. May you be happy. Excuse me. May your happiness continue. May it increase and may it never wane. It's the traditional phrase, right? Can we be content to just sincerely offer that one mudita wish? Can we just, with some contentment, patience, a loyalty, and an intimacy. Just be with the breath and the body breathing. So practicing mudita can be a support for the development of happiness, this happiness that supports the mind to relax enough to let go into these deep states of concentration. And what I love about this practice is, yes, we have the parameters of the practice, but we can play within the parameters. So perhaps you start a sit by tuning into any contentment that's present as you connect with the body, as you connect with sounds, as you drop into the breath. Maybe it's supportive for you to connect and commune with nature. You take in the stillness, the serenity, the beauty of the light, and that helps your body through mindfulness starts to take in and resonate with that peace, that serenity, the beauty. And that supports the heart mind in experiencing ease, relaxation, happiness. Wonderful ways of actually, and creative ways, and multiple ways of bringing in happiness as a foundation for our entry into practice, supporting awakening. So, our Dharma ancestor Buddhaghosa suggests that we not cultivate mudita for ourselves. And this made sense to me. It really made sense to me when I considered the phrase, the mudita phrase itself. May my happiness continue, may it increase, and may it never wane, right? That phrase could give rise to greed or attachment to our good fortune. But if you practice mudita as it's described in the suttas as a radiating practice, you just allow, you arouse the mudita, the joy, and the gladness, and you allow it to shine forth in all directions, blessing all beings. If you practice in that way, and if you use that text as a support, you'll be reminded that in the text it says, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world with the heart filled with mudita or gladness. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, and to all as to myself. So the suttas let us know that it's actually okay for us to cultivate mudita for ourselves. And we can cultivate mudita for ourselves with phrases. And when we do that, the practice takes on a flavor of gratitude, right? A flavor of gratitude for the blessings of our lives, for our good fortune. So we can shift the phrase to lessen the clinging that could arise with the phrase, may my good fortune continue, may it increase, and may it never wane. We just change the phrase to arouse and focus on the gratitude. We can change it to, may I appreciate the blessings of my life, or I appreciate the blessings of my life. Jill Shepherd, a colleague and practitioner, she taught me this beautiful phrase that I really love. It's, may this appreciation continue, may it grow, and may it lead to ever deepening ease and freedom. Isn't that gorgeous? I love it because the emphasis isn't on our good fortune and the blessings, it's on the mind state of gratitude, it's on the mind state of appreciation. That supports freedom, that supports this onward leading movement. Okay? The emphasis is on the mind state itself, this wholesome mind state of gratitude, and not on the good fortune itself. I love that. So there's a phrase in a chant, and I know some of you are familiar with this chant. It's the sharing of blessings chant. And the line in it that I really appreciate I'm reminded of a yogi I was just with during a long retreat who was also this phrase in this chant had landed in her heart, and it really moved her. It moved her so much that she was thinking about how could she change her life so that the Dhamma could be at the center. And the phrase is, "May all beings receive the blessings of my life." I love this phrase. May all beings receive the blessings of my life, right? So the blessings of our lives aren't to be hoarded for ourselves. They're intended to be shared. We're asked to give of them generously, to give of our gifts generously, allow them to flow through and out. And this is what I love about mudita. How can we actually share our gifts widely with everyone in our lives if we don't know what those gifts and blessings are? Right? There's a singer and a songwriter. Her name is Allie Halper, and she really understands that. This beautiful chant that I've just been carrying with me goes, "Loosen, loosen, baby. You don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. Let go, let go, let go. Loosen, loosen, sweetheart. You don't have to carry the weight of the world in your muscles and bones. Let go, let go, let go." I've just been carrying this chant with me, right? I learned this from Linda Tai, one of my teachers. Linda Tai is how to describe Linda? She's a storyteller, a therapist who specializes in trauma resolution and grief work. She's a healer, very extraordinary human. So I learned this chant from Linda Tai, who learned it from Allie Halpert. Now, if Allie Halpert hadn't recognized her gifts as a creator and carrier of songs, Linda wouldn't have heard this chant and have been moved by it and her heart resonate with it. And then she wouldn't have brought it to her community because she saw it as good medicine, right? She wouldn't have brought it to the community and the group of us who were practicing with her, who are currently practicing with her. It wouldn't have landed in my heart and my bones. And it has been such a support for living into particular insights lately. And then I wouldn't be sharing it here with you. And perhaps in sharing it with you, it'll touch your heart and you'll share it with someone else, right? So here's this gift of a song moving through these various communities because Allie Halper recognized the gifts and the blessings of her life and then shared them. It's just shared them widely. So it's okay for us to cultivate mudita for ourselves. Because doing so reveals our gifts and our good fortune, which we can share, and through sharing them, we bless each other. There are a lot of gifts that come with practicing mudita and metta. And cultivating metta and mudita for self can be an antidote for the adverse cultural messages we receive that end up shaping how we relate to each other and how we relate to ourselves. So there are some really well-intended, but ultimately adverse messages that we receive from the larger culture about, say, giving and caring for others, but at the expense of ourselves or our health. Messages about our worth being connected to our productivity and the type of work that we do. All of the messages we receive about our age in our religious identity, in our class, in our citizenship status, in our transgender bodies, in our queer bodies, in our femme bodies, in our male bodies, in our black and brown bodies, and our divergent or our neurodivergent heart. Messages that would have us internalize a collective disdain. And again, I'm really appreciating how Linda Tai frames what's at the center of all the harmful isms, sexism, classism, ableism, ageism. And I know we've been talking about it as othering in the larger culture, and it's helpful to frame it in that way. And it's also helpful to start to think about a little more, like what's at the center of this activity of othering, right? And there's some disrespect and even a contempt for particular groups of people. And the politics of our times can actually start to pander and use this collective disdain as a way to hoard power and resources for another group, to benefit another group. So I'm going to use an example from my own life, but feel free to apply it to your own situation, your own circumstances. So although I know the history of this country, and I know that the racism that I've experienced, that my mother has experienced, my uncles have experienced, my friends have experienced, I know it's about power. Right? It doesn't have anything to do with me personally. And yet there is an injury that can feel personal, an injury that can manifest as internalized devaluation that arises from the subtle and covert inculcation of this message of less than. This just repeated messages of less than. And this term, internalized devaluation, was coined by the psychologist Kenneth Hardy in a very powerful book called Racial Trauma. And this just doesn't, it doesn't apply just to race. It includes sexism and ableism and anti-Semitism and the anti-Palestinian sentiment that's afoot, and ageism and classism and heterosexism. I just want to use my own experience as an example. So Ta-Nehisi Coates speaks so directly and so powerfully to this process of internalized evaluation when he describes his experience and his years at Howard University, a historically Black college. He says there were 10,000 Black people in one spot, and they were beautiful. And I mean just physically beautiful people. And you have to understand what that means when you grow up in a culture when Black people are not depicted as beautiful. It's just not there. So Ta-Nehisi Coates and I are about the same age. We came of age during the 80s and the 90s. During the period of the super predator, right? Which is usually Black and brown. But during the era of the war on drugs and the war on crack cocaine, which devastated Black communities. So there were 10,000 Black people in one spot, and they were beautiful. I mean, just physically beautiful people. You have to understand what that means when you grow up in a culture where Black people are not depicted as beautiful. It's just not there. There's a subconscious message that's communicated in the culture that this is what's beautiful. This is what's elegant. This is what's intelligent. This is what's sophisticated. And this is white. It's not you. And for 4 years, man, I just got shot with the antidote to all of that. And so when I left, I felt so armed and confident. So for Ta-Nehisi Coates, it was being immersed in Howard and all that Black beauty and brilliance. For me, it's been the practice of metta, just learning to wish myself well, and the practice of mudita, really taking in my own gifts and beautiful qualities and my good fortune. So metta and mudita can serve as antidotes to internalized devaluation. And I say serve, and I use the present tense because the contempt of all of the isms that are run through people's nervous systems, through their bodies, through whole communities, the disdain that is run through the nervous system of Black and Brown bodies, it persists. And when I am met with that, it's been really helpful for me to lean into what's being called Black joy, right? Black people have been doing this since 1619, and you can hear this in a passage, a favorite passage. I say favorite because there are so many people that turn to this passage in Toni Morrison's Beloved. And as you hear this passage, listen for the joy surrounding and amid and woven through the pain and the challenge. Listen for how the mudita and the pain become a gateway for a collective practice of metta and mudita to heal a whole group of people, a whole community. Listen for and even see, just imagine with your mind's eye how this community practice of mudita and metta is a form of resistance and resilience. So after situating herself on a huge flat-sided rock, Baby Suggs bowed her head and prayed silently. The company watched her from the trees. They knew she was ready when she put her stick down. And then she shouted, "Let the children come." And they ran from the trees toward her. "Let your mothers hear you laugh," she told them, and the woods rang. The adults looked on and could not help but smile. "Then let the grown men come," she shouted. They stepped out one by one from among the ringing trees. "Let your wives and your children see you dance," she told them, and ground life shuddered under their feet. Finally, she called the women to her. "Cry," she told them, "for the living and the dead, just cry." And without covering their eyes, the women let loose. And it started that way, laughing children, dancing men, crying women, and then it got mixed up. Women stopped crying and danced. Men sat down and cried. Children danced. Women laughed. Children cried until exhausted and riven, all in each lay about the clearing, damp and gasping for breath. In the silence that followed, Baby Suggs Holy offered up to them her great big heart. She did not tell them to clean up their lives or to go and sin no more. She did not tell them they were the blessed of the earth, its inheriting meek or its glory bound pure. She told them that the only grace they could have was the grace they could imagine, that if they could not see it, they would not have it. "Here," she said, "in this here place, we flesh, flesh that weeps, laughs, flesh that dances on bare feet and grass. Love it. Love it hard. Love your hand. Love them. Raise them up and kiss them. Touch others with them. Pat them together. You got to love it. You. This is flesh I'm talking about here. Flesh that needs to be loved. Feet that need to rest and dance. Backs that need support. Shoulders that need arms. Strong arms, I'm telling you. So love your neck. Put a hand on it, grace it, stroke it, and hold it up. And all of your inside parts, you got to love them too. The dark, dark liver, love it, love it. And the beat and the beating heart, love that too. More than eyes or feet, more than lungs that have yet to draw free air, more than your life holding womb and your life-giving private parts. Hear me now, love your heart. For this is the prize. Saying no more, she stood up and danced with her twisted hip the rest of what her heart had to say, while the others opened their mouths and gave her the music. Long notes held until the four-part harmony was perfect enough for their deeply loved flesh. It's a ritual and a spell for casting out internalized contempt and the subsequent devaluation. It's a spell and a ritual and a practice that says we won't allow hate to lodge itself in our muscles, in our bones, or our hearts. So metta and mudita are fortifying the body, fortifying the heart for the slow and long work of freedom, internal freedom and external freedom. Well, the external freedom of deconstructing systems of oppression. Cleaver Cruz says it really beautifully. He's the founder of the Black Joy Project. He says, Black joy is not dismissing or creating an alternate Black narrative that ignores the realities of our collective pain. Rather, it's about holding the pain and injustice in tension with the joy we experience. It's about using that joy as an entry into understanding the oppressive forces we navigate through as a means to imagine and create a world free of them. So there's the external freedom that metta and mudita can help us to start to deconstruct. And there's this parallel internal process of freedom that metta and mudita can actually support, the abiding in the spacious quality of friendliness within the heart mind, abiding in the spaciousness and the joy of mudita. And the Buddha calls it a citta vimutti, a temporary liberation of mind. So that when we abide in mudita and we abide in metta, we get a taste of what a free heart and mind actually feels like. And it's temporary because we haven't fully uprooted greed, aversion, and delusion. Wisdom, along with metta, mudita, equanimity, and compassion, help to uproot it. But without the discernment, without the wisdom, it's temporary. And it's so necessary to allow our hearts to drink in and to know through mindfulness these boundless states of mudita and metta. It's like, oh, this is what freedom actually feels like and tastes like within my own heart and mind. This is where I'm headed. It becomes a North Star. A North Star that leads to this gradual experience of deconstructing, simplifying our experience. It's a beautiful verse that the Buddha recited, taught, offered, that describes this experience of Nibbana. Etang santang etang panitang yaditang. This is peaceful, etang satang. This is sublime, namely, etang santang etang panitang yadidang sabba sankara samatto, a calming of all construction, sabbupatti patti nissango, the letting go of all support. Tanhatankayo, the extinguishing of craving. Virago, dispassion. Nirodo, cessation. Cessation. Letting go of constructing all the meaning making that we do through attention and contact and vedana and perception and intention. Letting all of that just cease. Nippon, Nippon. So metta and mudita can be a support for this parallel process of freedom. attending to the oppressive systems that we live in and deconstructing them. And also deconstructing the meaning making that we're always involved in, right? Allowing the internal landscape of the heart mind to just get more and more simple. It's quite peaceful. Etang santang etang panitang yadi dang saba sankara samato sabupati patinisango tanhaṅkayo virago nirodho nibbana. Let's just sit, let the word settle for a couple of minutes or so.